This is a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat with guest Tommy Womack. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com. And this is another edition of No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, and with me today is Tommy Womack, who's up here to do a show tonight at the Honky Tonk House Concert Series. How you doing there, Tommy?
I'm doing fine. How you doing, Diesel?
Pretty good, pretty good. It's going to be a good show tonight, I think, the first one of the season here.
This is the first one.
This is the first one of the year, yeah.
I'm the inaugural. All right.
Indeed. So it's great to have you up here and get the festivities going at Jay and Tammy's again.
It's great to be back, yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about with you, but I don't usually do this. But before we start, I want to tell a little story of my own. Just to give you an idea here of where I'm coming from. The first time I ever heard of you, I was out west somewhere, California, Arizona, something like that. And I was driving around on one of my cross-country trips, and I had the satellite radio on Outlaw Country.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their crazy DJs, probably Mojo Nixon or one of them, decided to play Alpha Male and the K9 Mystery Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know that song, it's about 7 minutes long, and after about 30 seconds, I'd listened to it and I was thinking, I have no idea what the hell is going on here, but I like it. And then by the time it got to the line about why did Jesus have to die, why couldn't he just be some nice Jewish guy, I was thinking, this is one of the coolest things I've ever heard. And so that was my introduction to you. And the really funny part about that, to me at least, was at the time, I was tooling around in a Ford Econoline 150 van, which was later than the van that you had when you were in Government Cheese, but almost the exact same thing. And in fact, I had the two captain's chairs with the cooler right in the middle, like you guys did.
Yeah.
So later on, when I read your book, I found that quite hilarious that I was in that van when I first heard you. So I did actually mention for a second there, not only are you a singer and a songwriter and a guitar player, but you're pretty accomplished author, in my estimation.
Yeah, I've got two books published. I'm working on a third right now.
Okay, great, great. Well, I guess we'll sort of start at the beginning of your career and maybe suss that out a little bit. You started out with a band called Government Cheese.
Government Cheese, right.
Indeed. And you were kind of present at the creation of the kind of punk country mixture.
Yeah, I was there at ground zero.
Absolutely.
A lot of it, yeah.
And you you were influenced a lot, and I know you hung out a lot with the guys from what was then Jason and the Nashville Scorchers.
Yeah.
Later became Jason and the Scorchers. So what was that like in those early days when, you know, they were just coming up with that whole punk country scene?
Well, I was going to college in Bowling Green, Kentucky at the time, which was an hour north of Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not a lot went on in Bowling Green, but I had a couple of friends who were really hip and were really into the punk scene and had a lot of the cool records that I didn't have. And one night they took me down to see Jason and the Nashville Scorchers at Cantrell's in Nashville. And it changed my life. It was They're still a great band, but my God, what they were when they were young and self-destructive and maniacs. It was really something to see and hear. And I was bowled over and became not only a fan, but it reinforced the fact, looking at them, that I want to do this. This is what I want to make my life about. And I've had two phases of involvement with Jason and the Scorchers. There was a few years there where I would see Warner in a bar in Nashville and just chase him around asking how he played this lick or that lick.
The lead guitar player.
Yeah, the lead guitar player. And I wrote him letters asking about things like that. And I was considered a pest to the band. You know, I would always show up at the gigs and try to get backstage and ask them questions and tell them how great they were. So few years go by, more than a few actually, and I wrote that book, Cheese Chronicles, and it came out in 95. And it has parallel story. It's the story of government cheese, but it's also in bits and pieces the story of Jason and the Scorchers. And Warner read that book and called me up one night and was just raving about it. He couldn't believe it. He saw a whole new side to me after that book. And Jason read it and loved it and suggest. And by then, I had had a little bit of success as a musician. And Jason said, well, why don't we try to write a song sometime? And the first song we wrote was Going Nowhere, which turned up on the Clear Impetuous Morning record. And I wound up writing or co-writing four songs on that record, four or five. And then on the next record, I had co-writing credits on another four, I think. And I've just been really close to those guys ever since. And there's kind of two Tommies involved with Jason and the Nashville Scorchers, the Pest back in the mid-80s, and the Collaborator that started in the mid to late 90s and has continued ever since. You know, I've written some records for the Dan Baird and Homemade Sin record that Jason and Warner are part of. Written some for the Scorchers, obviously. Co-written a couple of them on Jason's solo records. And that's been a really gratifying thing to be involved in their career like that, is, you know, when they changed my life as much as they did.
Right. Well, I guess that kind of just shows how, you know, we sort of all grow as people. You know, you started out as the kind of underling wanting to find out all about what they did, and you ended up being a colleague, basically.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And then, you know, because of that experience, I guess, being influenced by them and deciding that you wanted to be in a band, you founded Government Cheese, which is a little more, I would personally say, straight punk than maybe those guys are. But you did have some definite country punk influences.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, to my personal feelings, wrote one of the great early country punk singles, which was Come On Back to Bowling Green and Marry Me.
Yeah.
That's a terrific song.
Thank you.
And it's right in that vein, so I totally see why you you dug Jason and the Scorchers.
Yeah. Pitched that song to him at one time. I got John Cowan of Newgrass Revival to give a cassette copy to Jason. Nothing came of it, but, you know, I was always ambitious that way. I still play Come On Back to Bowling Green in my shows.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll look forward to that, because it's one of my favorites.
I still play that. I still play Fish Stick Day. I every now and then play Camping on Acid. I even play Mamaw Drives the Bus every now and then. And that's one that I didn't originally sing, you know, but I sing it, obviously, because I'm playing alone. I have to sing it. I like playing those old songs. I avoided them for a while. I wanted to carve a new path, but I like them now.
Okay. So I guess if I were to describe your career trajectory as it looks from, you know, the sort of corporate media high towers that they have, you've kind of gone back and forth a little bit between complete obscurity and sort of just barely on the radar. Which I think is what kind of makes your book that you mentioned, Cheese Chronicles, so fascinating. Because, you know, if you want to know what Bob Dylan had for breakfast on June 3rd, 1974, there's probably a book out there that'll tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, all you get to hear about are these big superstars. But what was great about your book was, you know, you were sort of in the minor leagues, maybe like a AAA baseball team, you know, trying to work your way up to the majors.
Sure.
And so it's not a book about music, but music is the backdrop for the story about the people and the band and what you were doing. So I just think it was great, and I want to recommend it to all of our listeners. You know, if you get a chance, go out and get Tommy's book, Cheese Chronicles. Because even if you've never heard of Government Cheese, it is a great read, and you'll want to learn more once you do.
Yeah, it's the story of every band. You can take out Government Cheese's name and put your own band's name in there, and it's all the stuff every band goes through. Riding in a van, getting tired of each other's company, sleazy manager, bad contract, then wearing yourself out and breaking up, you know, spending you know, 14 hours in a van at a stretch. It's all in there. It's all in there.
Okay. And I guess something you just mentioned with the sleazy manager and bad contract, it's a story of a lot of bands. You know, they end up signing a contract because they just want a contract and they don't have any real power.
Yeah.
So they end up in this sort of situation. Do you feel like, you know, maybe if things had been different, if you had a different manager, if you, you know, had a different set of circumstances, that that band might have become, you know, a famous type band? Or...
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Okay. I mean, flat out answer. There you go. Yeah. But I guess, you know, at some point you kind of realize that wasn't going to happen. And you write about that a little bit in your book and in some of your more recent songs. So I guess you kind of moved on after that. And you started to work more in the more straight alt-country, country kind of vein, Americana kind of stuff. What brought on that change? What sort of had you leaving the punk influences behind?
The sound of punk, after a few years, gets to be a bit like a nagging wife. You want to move on to new pastures. And I wrote a bunch of slower, softer songs in my days with the Cheese. They just couldn't use them. We used a few of them. And a lot of my songs started, you know, going back to Bowling Green and Marry Me, started as a country song.
Right.
Somewhere Between started as a country song. There's several that I'm blanking on now, but yeah, a lot of my songs when I was just playing them in the living room, you know, come on back to Bowling Green and marry me. My mama's on drugs and I need somebody to take care of me. That's where it started, and it just became, you know, you just change it up a little bit. A lot of Jason and the Scorchers tunes are that way too. And as I got older, and Nashville's a country town, it tends to rub off on you a little bit. And I don't like much country music. To this day, I don't listen to a lot of country music. The country music I like is usually like the way the Rolling Stones played it, or the way the real old-timers played it. Hank Williams Sr., guys like that, Farron Young. That's what I like. And I don't listen to it much. I don't listen to much Americana at all. I am an Americana artist. That's what they consider me. Such as I can be classified, and I'm not meaning to brag when I say this, but the fact is I am unclassifiable. I don't know any artist who does what I do, which is sort of a jazzy, slightly rocking country blues with some poetry spoken word aspects to it. That's in comedy, you know. That's what I do. And I don't know where you categorize all that, but for the main songs I sing, like, I'm on and off the wagon, I go from day to day. Yeah, that's country, all right. So I do that much country, so I'm an Americana artist. And they got a category. You gotta be labeled somehow, otherwise the business doesn't know how to sell you.
Right.
The business has never really known how to sell me a bunch. Radio's never been able to play me much, because I might give you one country song on the record, and then there's not another one to follow up with.
Right. But you have had, you know, certain successes here and there.
Here and there.
And certainly you... after Government Cheese, you had sort of an experimental kind of thing with the Biscuits.
Yeah.
However you want to pronounce that.
Biscuits.
Biscuits, however, yeah. Did you guys actually pronounce the Biscuits with the straight up, like
yeah,
the food?
It was pronounced the Biscuits. Grimey calls it Biscuits now, but I was there. I remember when the band was born. And the reason people call it Biscuits to this day was because the first gig we ever did as the Biscuits, I drew a picture for Tommy Meyer's bass drum front. And what I did, I wanted to draw a biscuit, and I needed a model of a biscuit, so I got a box of Bisquick.
Okay.
And I drew a big biscuit on the front of his bass drum, and then I made a little logo, and I spelled it Bisquits, because I was looking at the biscuit.
Okay.
Bisquit. I was looking at the Bisquick box.
Right, which has the hyphen in it.
And it has a Q. So I spelled it with a Q, and then we did a copyright search on Bisquit after we'd already discovered the misspelling. Mm-hmm. And there is a stuffed plush animal company called a Bisquit. That's what they call their product. So we put a hyphen in between the S and the Q, and that created all the confusion. And some people call it the Bisquits now that we're in the frickin' band. Grimy calls it that. And I think because most people pronounce it the Bisquits, and it's troublesome to correct them all the time.
There you go.
During the course of the band, we were the Biscuits.
Okay.
And I still call it the Biscuits.
Okay, well, it's your band, so you can call whatever you want.
I got the prerogative there.
But thank you for correcting me on that, too, because I wasn't around back then. So
you can call it the Biscuits. It
okay.
don't matter.
Well, anyway, you guys only came out with one studio album.
One studio
name, right?
album.
But it did have what I feel is a classic song, among some other pretty good ones, for sure. But the one that I really attached to was Betty Was Black and Willie Was White.
Yeah.
And you still do that one occasionally, too,
I still
too, right?
do that one occasionally.
Okay. Can you just maybe talk about that song a little bit and how that came about? Because it's a really interesting song to me.
I wrote a lot of songs without pen and paper. I was real good at it in my 20s.
Okay.
I can't do it so much now. I have to write them down on paper as I go along. My memory isn't as strong. But my theory has always been, if you can remember the lines you've come up in your head in a row, if you can keep remembering what you just added to it, then it's a memorable line. And I was cleaning the house one day in Bowling Green in the apartment that my future wife Beth and I were sharing. This is about 1990. And I'm just, you know, sweeping the floors, straightening up things. And I came up with Betty Was Black and Willie Was White. Betty and Willie got it on one night. And I went, holy moly, that's great. That's great. And then as I was cleaning the house, I kept coming up with other lines. The next one, they crawled in a bottle of Tanqueray and fell in love that very day. And not writing down any of it. And I don't think I wrote the song down on paper until we had to print the lyrics for the sleeve of the Biscuits record 4 years ago, 4 years later. I was able to do that, and I'm still able to remember a lot of words in songs. I have several long songs with lots of words in them, and I'm able, that's just a gift I have, I'm able to remember words like that. Kind of like an actor who remembers a whole Shakespearean soliloquy, you know. I'm sure it's the same part of the brain you store that stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I ever did it, I like to surprise the cheese guys on stage with new raps and poems and stuff that the audience had never heard, and they had never heard either. I would hold the band hostage for a few minutes while I just ran off at the mouth. And one night before Yellow Clean Peaches, I recited Betty Was Black. And blew their minds. And we tore into Yellow Clean Peaches after that, and after the
show,
so it
was just completely a spoken word poem at that point.
Completely
so.
Spoken word poem at that
okay.
point, and it the band never learned it. I came up with a slide guitar riff to go with it in open A tuning.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do it in concert tuning, and it goes a little like. messed it up. Anyway, I got to warm up to play that.
Yeah.
But I tried to replicate the slide guitar open tuning riff in a concert tuning. Mm-hmm. And I promise, if you ever come see me live, I'll get it right.
There you go.
And so the Government Cheese broke up not too long after that. And I played it for the Biscuits once. And they really liked it. And it became one of the first songs we ever worked up. And Todd Snyder recorded that song
mm-hmm.
about the year 2000 or so.
Sounds about right to me. Yeah. I love his version, too.
Yeah, it's a good version.
It's always good to hear in the original, too, and the version that you guys did was terrific, I thought.
Yeah, it's got some good guitar work on it. That Biscuits record has so much good guitar work on it. I really like that record still.
And that was about the era, correct me if I'm wrong, when you moved from Bowling Green to Nashville initially,
yeah.
wasn't it?
I moved to Nashville April 1st, 1992, and the Biscuits started within weeks.
Okay.
Grimey got me invited to a jam session with the other guys in the band, who were already a band because they were backing up Colin Wade Monk at his gigs. And we became our own band. And by the middle of that summer, we were attracting a crowd, and we became one of the most popular bands in Nashville. Nobody knew who we were outside of Nashville,
mm-hmm.
but we were big time in Nashville. And John Prine's label, Oh Boy, signed us. We did one record. Then we broke up in 95, I think. And that's when I went to work at a bookstore and wrote Cheese Chronicles.
Okay.
It's the only time in almost 30 years that I didn't play music for a while. I wrote songs at home and put them on my four-track, but I didn't play gigs. I just worked at that bookstore and worked on my book at night.
And was that your first sort of straight job since you'd been working radio station gigs before Government Cheese?
No, I worked at a car wash for a while.
Oh, yeah.
In the last couple of years of Government Cheese, when we were starting to dip in popularity and weren't making the money that we were, and I had to get another job.
Okay.
So I worked at a car wash for maybe 2 years, off and on.
So if you want a real picture of life in a band, it starts off with you having a day job and going crazy trying to play all the night gigs, and then getting good enough to where you can quit the day job, and then when it ends, you got to get a day job again.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that's sort of the story there.
I've had day jobs off and on ever since then.
Okay.
You know, I make about half my living playing music and about the other half working odd day jobs.
Okay.
And I wish there's part of me that is always telling myself that I'm not truly successful because I still have a day job. But there's a lot of truly successful acts out there that the minute they get off the road, they're not getting paid again.
Mm-hmm.
And they work other jobs, you know. Jason Ringenberg worked construction for years whenever he wasn't playing. Warner Hodges, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, you know, it's better than having to be on the road absolutely constantly, or you don't eat, I guess, right?
Yeah, I would not want to be on the road constantly. It stops being fun when you're about 3 weeks out.
And you've still got a lot of road to go over at that point, right?
I've never been on the road more than 3.5 months, and by the third week, you're getting really homesick. I'm a homebody.
Mm-hmm.
I like being around my family. I like sitting in my bedroom watching television and pecking on my laptop. That's where I like to be. And, you know, these weekend runs, like playing these gigs this weekend, that's my sort of thing. I like to play on the weekends and, you know, and I can get into going a couple of weeks playing. That's actually kind of fun, because
mm-hmm.
when you're playing gigs and you're on the road traveling from one spot to the next, all the big questions about how you're going to live your life and what you're going to do with your life go out the window. You know what your job is and what your purpose in life is every day when you're on the road. You get up, you have breakfast, you drive to the next gig, you sound check, you play the gig, go to the hotel, you sleep, repeat, repeat, repeat. There's no existential angst about what am I doing with my life. This is what I'm doing with my life. I play these gigs, and that's what I do.
Okay. And I, to me, that was one of the more interesting aspects of what you said in Cheese Chronicles, was that you felt like, you know, after those years on the road, you hadn't really grown as a person or even as a musician much.
No, I
haven't. Because you'd just been out there hitting the road.
Yeah.
So do you feel like now, with this slower schedule, you have more of an opportunity to, you know, live your own life and even work more as a musician on, you know, becoming something that you want to be?
Yeah, yeah. Being on the road kind of freezes you in one spot, developmentally. You know, look at Keith Richards. That guy's, I've read enough about Keith Richards. I'm a Stones junkie.
Okay.
I've read as much as, you know, you can about him as you can read about any historical figure and know what made them tick and know who they are. And he's 19 years old. He hasn't developed a bit. And I wouldn't want to be that guy. I admire his musicianship, but I wouldn't want to be somebody in such a case of arrested development as that is.
Well, I suppose then that kind of brings you into the next phase of your career, because you kind of had a few projects going after the Biscuits, but it's really sort of after that is when you moved into the solo phase.
Yeah.
And like I said, the first time I heard you was right after the album There I Said It came out in 2007. And so that was sort of your coming back album and your coming out as a solo artist album.
Yeah, yeah. I had three solo records that came out before then, but they were totally different kinds of records. I didn't write very much about myself. I wrote about other people, and I wrote about third-person narratives trying to be Ray Davies. And I got some good reviews. People liked it, but it wasn't grabbing people by the throat. And on There I Said It, I was working a terrible job at the time, and, you know, life wasn't really very good. And I wrote all these songs about, you know, being terrified of dying poor, hating my day job. One of the songs is called I'm Never Gonna Be a Rock Star. You know, coming to grips. It was a record about coming to grips with real life and all its fears and burdens and obligations. And I almost stopped the record from coming out because I thought, this is too personal. Nobody's going to care about all this stuff. But I went ahead and put it out, and everything exploded. People loved it. And every time I play Nice Day, there's people in the audience that practically cry because that's their life too. You know, one whoever said most men live lives of quiet desperation, well, I tapped into that with that song in particular, Nice Day, and with Alpha Male, and a few others, Cockroach After the Bomb. Yeah, that record made me. I found my voice. I used that voice on the next record, Now What? And if I write songs that are just love songs that anybody could sing, then I have an outlet for that too with the Daddy Records. With the records with Will Kimbrough in that band.
Right, right. Which was sort of between those two eras, between the Biscuit, and he was in the Biscuits with you too.
He was in the Biscuits
right?
with me too. Will and I have played off and on for over 20 years now.
Okay. So I guess you sort of talked about the process that led you to that album, but, you know, I sort of want to talk about a couple of the songs on there because it is a terrific album. And I guess we should start off with the one that I first heard, which I still think is one of the best songs that I've ever heard, which was Alpha Male and the Canine Mystery Blood. That is, at the same time, a crazy, whacked out, totally off-the-wall song, but it's also a really personal story, you know, about this guy and how he's lived his life, and, you know, a lot of parallels, I guess, with your life as well. So how did you come up with the idea to sort of insert all that personal stuff into this kind of off-the-wall story about this band with this crazy name?
Well, there is two things that kind of affected me and were affecting me at the time I wrote that. I hated my day job. Thought my music career was totally done. And I was walking to work on Vanderbilt's campus one day, and I passed this poster stapled to a phone pole advertising Josh Rouse's New Year's Eve gig at the Exit Inn. Josh Rouse and I released our first two solo records the same day in 1998. He went ballistic, you know, he got very successful. Patty Griffin released her solo record, first one, that same release date.
Oh, that was a fun Tuesday.
Yeah, and so here I am, a failure, walking to work, and I see this poster for Josh Rouse playing New Year's Eve at Exit Inn, and that's the poster.
Okay.
I changed the name, and I made up that they were opening for Death Cab for Cutie, and then I just got into telling the story of my life, and just continued to. I had those two, I had that poster in my head, and I went to a bar in Franklin, Tennessee to see a friend play a show, and I was sitting at the bar, and I got seized with this whole tune, and I wanted to start writing lyrics, and I didn't have a piece of paper, I didn't have a pen. I asked the bartender for a pen, and he got me that. I asked him if he had any paper, and he said he didn't. I said, well, can you spit me out some cash register rhythm? And he did. He spit me out about a four-foot-long section of it. I said, can you spit me another one out that long? And he did. And I wrote Alpha Male in about 20 minutes at that bar.
That's pretty impressive, because that's only about three times as long as the song is itself.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess it just kind of came flowing at that point.
Yeah,
just one of those songs.
It was pouring out of me, yeah.
And that's the way it sounds, too. I mean, like you said, it's one of those sort of spoken word pieces that you have. Yeah. But it's really just a kind of a train of thought kind of a thing about, you
know, stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. Yeah. But I believe, you know, to be good writing, you have to, you start with one subject, and you can wind your way all over the world talking, but you bring people back to the first subject that you were talking about, which was Alpha Male and the Canine Mystery Blood, the band.
Mm-hmm.
The song begins with them, and it ends with them. Writing is like taking people on a bus for a tour, and you always let them back off at the same stop they got on, because that's where their cars are, you
right.
know? You pick people up at a certain spot / topic, and you drop them back off at the same place.
But in the middle, you go through all
the
cool sights
and everything.
In the
middle, you can go crazy, yeah.
Okay, well, that's an interesting philosophy, but I like it.
Yeah.
So, along with that song, and a bunch of others that are sort of strewn between those two records that we mentioned, there's kind of a lot about, you know, as you said, very personal stuff about, you know, your career and its trajectory and how things have changed for you. You know, things like 25 Years Later sort of has that theme in I'm Never Gonna Be a Rock Star.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get that?
I'm Never Gonna Be a Rock Star.
Never Gonna, okay. I couldn't remember if it was never or not, but okay. So I guess what's interesting about those is you're singing about a lot of stuff that, you know, nobody ever really wants to sing about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, between those two albums, you kind of seem to have become comfortable with your situation. And maybe a little bit is because of the success of the first album there. But, you know, by the time you reach 2012, when... help me out here, what was the name of that album? Your last one.
Now What.
Now What. I'm sorry, I just totally blanked on that for some reason. By the time Now What came out, you know, you seem to be in a pretty comfortable place comparatively.
As comfortable as I get.
Okay.
art is a great way of getting your frustrations and mixed feelings and anxiety out. If you give words to what you're feeling, kind of neutralizes the feeling some. So yeah, it's helped my mental health. It certainly did in Cheese Chronicles. I came out of the government cheese experience very bitter. And I'm writing that book was my first experience at being able to purge all the bitterness out about something. Okay. And I never feel bad about any of that stuff anymore.
So is there a lot of catharsis in just writing it out and getting it out there for the world?
Absolutely.
Okay. So is that sort of one of the main things that drives you as a songwriter? Is just, you know, personally being able to say something even if you don't know if anybody out there is going to be interested in it?
No, I don't hold myself to a specific topic when I write it, but though it does happen that the topics that I'm writing about do tend to be personal stuff, but that's not the absolute reason to begin the song. I'm just trying to write a good song. I usually get the first two lines, and if they're good, then I work from there.
Okay. So, given your career as a whole, you know, all the way back from the early 80s on up to now, what are a couple of the songs that you're still really proud of?
Nice Day's the best song I've ever written.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit about how that one came about? Because that is a very good song. And
I wrote the lyrics on Todd Snyder's tour bus, maybe 2005. And I came home and I said, "Buddy, I've written a song about you." And he was the first one to ever hear it. And when I had the words in front of me, but I had no tune, none. I was just going to wing it. So I started playing the same three chords over and over again. It's been a nice day. We all went swimming, me and my sweetheart and our boy. It's been a nice day. We all went swimming, etc. It's the same three chords all the way through the song. Because I didn't have anything else. I didn't have any idea what the chords were going to be. And it was such a moving moment. I sang that song for him. And he scooted over to me on the front porch and put his arm around me. And I knew the song was done. That's the way the song was going to be the rest of its life.
Nice.
And that one I'm really proud about. I'm proud of Come On Back to Bowling Green and Marry Me. I'm proud of Cold Wind off the Biscuits record. That's a really good one. I'm proud of 90 Miles an Hour Down a Dead End Street.
That, for people who are listening, if you don't know it, that's a great one.
That's a spoken word.
Yeah.
You might even call it a rap.
Okay, I wouldn't personally, because I'm not a rap fan, and I'm a fan of that song, but no, it's a great one, and actually, it kind of reminds me of a Todd Snyder song, 40 Miles. Yeah. It's sort of the same kind of idea in a lot of ways, although he's getting into a car accident, and you've got this metaphorical car on the road. So I've always found that kind of funny, because I dig both of those songs.
And I would have to mention Alpha Male.
Uh-huh.
I'm really proud of that one. I'm really proud of one of my most recent songs, You Don't Get Over Love. I think that one's really good.
Okay.
That's a new one. It's not on any record yet.
Will you be playing it tonight?
Yeah, I'll play it tonight.
All right. Well, then I'll get to know it then. So I want to, in light of those that you're very proud of, want to talk to you about one that you sort of talked about in the book not being so proud of, which is Fish Sticks. which for people who don't know it is just a crazy chant kind of a song with pretty much just drums in the background, right? How do you feel about that song today, you know, all this time later?
I love it. I'm totally over it. Okay. I play it. I played it. I don't think I played it last night, but I played it Thursday night. I play it all the time. I get a kick out of it now. I don't have any complex about Fish Stick Day anymore, even though I did hate it Scuts at one time. See, comedy songs take over the act. And the better your serious songs become, the less of a dichotomy it becomes. But comedy songs tend to take over the act. People want to hear the funny songs. And I resented that in my 20s because I wanted to be cool like Bono. And if you're a funny rock band, if you're funny, you're not cool somehow.
Okay.
And when you get my age, it's not an issue anymore.
Okay. So, was it just... Do you think that the nature of the song being so crazy and it being so funny that made people latch onto it originally? Because it seems to be one of the songs that people remember from Government Cheese when they remember the band.
Yeah, it was very catchy. It was a smash hit. I mean, it was great, great. I mean, it's a great song for what it is. It's not very melodically interesting or anything, but if you get something that hits that people really like, you know, hang on to it. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, that's true enough. So I guess just to wrap up then, what do you feel is next for you going down the road? Are you pretty happy with the way things are going with your music right now? And are you going to keep going for a while at this pace?
I'm happy that I'm playing gigs, and I'm happy that there's opportunities to write songs with people. I'm not happy with my career at all. I'm really a bit disconcerted about, you know, I don't have a manager. I don't have a booking agent. I'm not good at either one of those things. There's always a friend of mine in Nashville who's doing better than I am. And when somebody has a real good big break come their way, I'm resentful, I'm petty. So career-wise, I'm not very happy. Artistically, I'm pretty happy. I mean, I've got a lot of good things in my life. I have a wonderful wife and child. I have a few thousand people who think I'm great. You know, I get to make records. I'm sure I'll make another one. I'm going to try to get this next book finished before I do that. I don't want to multitask too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm a good person. I didn't always feel that way. You know, I'm going out on the road. I'm not cheating on my wife. I'm not driving drunk anymore. I'm not getting drunk at all. I'm not going on stage high. I'm doing things. I'm doing the best shows of my life, I think. And I'm enjoying them more than I ever have, I think. You know, it gets to be a richer experience the more I do it. And for better or for worse, I'm pretty sure I'll be doing it the rest of my life, too. And, you know, that's okay.
Okay.
I'm afraid of dying poor. That's the biggest bugaboo.
Right.
But I got a really smart, practical wife that I think will definitely help take care of me. And every day I manage to eat at some point. It's never been a problem finding something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So compared to, you know, people in Somalia, I'm all right.
Well, there you go. And I guess, in a way, both with Government Cheese and as a solo artist, you kind of hinted at this, but you are kind of a cult figure. You know, Government Cheese was a band that was really, really loved by a small number of people,
yeah.
Kind of in a specific geographic region, mostly around Kentucky and Tennessee, although you did break out some other places. And now, you know, you're an incredibly well-respected singer-songwriter, but by people who are in the know.
Yeah.
So do you feel like that, in and of itself, is any kind of an accomplishment? That, you know, people who really know good music think that you're among the best songwriters working right now? Or?
Diesel, all I ever wanted to be, aside from being, aside from being hugely well-known, the only other cool thing that I thought would be really cool to be is to be a cult favorite. I didn't consider much how little money cult favorites make and how frustrating it could be to be a cult favorite and wish to be higher up the food chain, but I wanted to be a cult favorite, and I am one. So, you know, in that respect, I've made it.
So maybe you're not quite living the dream that you had when you saw that Kiss ad on TV.
Yeah.
Which, for those of you who haven't read his book, is sort of where this whole music obsession started.
Yeah.
But that's a pretty good dream to have, and in that way you've accomplished it. So
yeah.
Congratulations on that. That's pretty cool, actually.
Thank you.
And, you know, a lot of those kind of cult bands, you know, one way or another, have great influence down the line. I mean, look at the Velvet Underground.
Sure.
You know, how many people bought a Velvet Underground album back in the day, but then how many of them wanted to start their own band just because of that?
Absolutely.
So, sometimes, I guess, a cult's favorite is a good thing to be, so that's pretty cool. And in fact, your I guess, cult status kind of led to an interesting fact up here in Northern Ohio. Some good friends of ours are called the Womack Family Band.
Yeah,
and it's kind of a tribute to you.
It's a tribute to me?
Well, in a crazy roundabout way, because you know Chris Castle, right?
Yes,
you
I
met
do.
Him. They originally worked together in just a sort of a one-off. They kind of came up with the name the Womack Brothers. Just as, you know, sort of, we're going to play a gig today, let's just throw it in. And eventually, through a lot of crazy things, that kind of formed into the Womack Family Band. So,
well, I'll be.
In some ways, you know, you've got a little bit of a tribute there. And I know those guys are, you know, kind of up-and-comers here on the local scene. So, who knows? You know, maybe one way or another, your name will keep living on long after you do.
That's great. That's great. I love Chris Castle. He's a great guy and a great talent.
Absolutely. In fact, he was the very first interview I did here at this house. We sat right here, and he's a great guy to talk to, just like you are. You know, some great stories and all that. But it is probably time for us to get going downstairs and get ready to play your gig. So, Tommy, I really want to thank you for being here. It was terrific to talk to you. And for all of our listeners out there, as I said, Tommy is not only an awesome songwriter, he's a great author, too, and you should check out Cheese Chronicles and learn all about a band that you might not know anything about. And what's the next book that you're working on?
It's called 365 Days.
Okay.
And I started on my birthday, November 20th, 2011, and ended it on my birthday in 2012. And now I'm in the process of cleaning up the text, editing, adding in memories that I missed in the first go-around, and really just, I'm really nitpicky about my writing. I'll look over the same sentence 10 minutes, you know.
I'm the same way.
Yeah. A friend asked, Oscar Wilde had a lunch with a friend one day. And friend asked him, "So, Oscar, what have you done so far today?" And he said, "I put in a comma." And that's kind of how my writing goes. I really, really labor over it.
Well, that's I think that's a thing that a lot of, you know, great writers have in common, is that sort of anal streak to make everything perfect, and that's why their books come out so great.
You want flow. My writing is very musical. People read with their people move their mouths when they read, even if they're not physically doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't put a word that ends in S next to a next word that begins with S. You don't do that. You don't use the same word twice in the same paragraph, mm-hmm. or even in the same two paragraphs if you can.
That's one of my pet peeves for sure.
Yeah. You do everything you can to pull the reader's eyes across the sentence and the next sentence all through the book. You know, that's what they call being compulsively readable. There's never any sort of faux pas, like the same thing, end of a word with T, right in front of a word that begins with T, that sort of thing. You don't do anything that's going to mess up people moving their lips when they're reading.
Okay. And I bet, you know, as a singer, that that helps you think about it, too, because you've been up on stage singing and you don't want to do that
with lyrics, right. either.
Absolutely. So, that's an interesting take on being a longer form writer. I've never really thought of it that way, so that's pretty cool. But like I said, you know, check out Tommy's books, because not only is he an anal writer, as he just said, but he is a terrific visual writer and tells some great stories. And also, you know, as a songwriter, there are a few people out there who can match him. So if you want to change your life, go out and get any one of his last two, or either one of his last two albums, which are There I Said It and Now What, and it really will change your life.
And everything's on Amazon, too. You can get Cheese Chronicles, and you can get my Civil War short story, The Lavender Boys and Elsie. It's also, you know, it's on Amazon, and I have a relationship with an on-demand printer that you order the book, they print one copy of it and send it straight to you. They do all the fulfillment, they send the book to you. So definitely go to Amazon. People want me to get the money when they order the book, but it gets to you faster, and I do get the money.
Okay.
It might be 3 months later, but I'll get it.
Well, there you go. So technology has made it easier than ever. You don't have to hunt through the racks to find that old copy of Come On Back to Bowling Green somewhere in the record store. Yeah. You can just go online and find everything he's ever written. So
and everything's terrific. On iTunes, too, and Amazon MP3 services like that. You can get my last four solo records are on there, last five. You can get the Government Cheese record on iTunes. I think you can even get the Biscuits record on iTunes. So.
Awesome. Well, everybody out there, check all of those out because they are some great music. And Tommy, I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's been really great to
meet you and talk to you. So, everybody, we're getting ready for a great show. And if you ever get the chance, believe me, go out and see Tommy Womack because he's a great act. Anyway, thanks again, Tommy.
How you doing, brother?
This is one more edition of No Surf's Music Burning River Fireside Chats, and this is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, signing off. This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.